There is a very specific kind of anxiety in engineering. It's that moment, that gap between the spreadsheet and the soldering iron. You know the feeling I'm talking
Oh,
about.
absolutely. It works on my machine problem, but on a much bigger scale.
Right. You can have the most perfect theoretical models, your math is flawless, the simulations run like a dream, but then comes that moment of truth. You have to actually flash that code onto a piece of silicon, a real chip, and see if it works in the real world.
And that's where the rubber meets the road, or in this case, where the balloon meets the stratosphere.
And that is exactly where we're going today. We're doing a deep dive into H3 Lite hardware validation based on the engineering logs from the Stratasan development blog.
This is the follow-up to our last discussion on the theory. The challenge was, can we teach a high-altitude balloon to understand complex borders without giving it, a supercomputer for a brain?
And the question for today is simple, but it's brutal. Does it actually work? We're not talking theory anymore. We're talking milliseconds, kilobytes, and the specific panic of seeing if your code crashes the hardware.
And whether you can cram a map of the world's radio regulations into a chip with less memory than a single email.
So let's set the scene. We are moving from the whiteboard to the actual rig. What is the specific hardware we are putting through the wringer here?
Okay, so we're looking at the STM32WLE5JC.
That is a mouthful. It sounds like a generic part number, but I know this chip is kind of a big deal in the IoT world.
It is, yeah. It's a really popular choice because it has a LoRa long-range radio built right into the silicon. But computationally, it's modest. It's an ARM Cortex-M4 running at 48 megahertz.
48 megahertz. I just want to pause on that for a second because we lose all perspective on these numbers. If you're listening to this on a modern smartphone, your phone is running literally thousands of times faster than that.
Oh, easily. It's comparing a go-kart to a Formula One car. But speed isn't even the biggest problem here. The real bottleneck is the memory.
Okay.
This chip has 256 kilobytes of flash, that's your hard drives, basically, and only 64 kilobytes of RAM.
64K of RAM. That is an incredibly tight sandbox. I was thinking, if you open a blank text document on your laptop, the system overhead is probably using 10 times that just to blink the cursor.
Easily. And in that tiny little space, the system has to run the balloon's flight controls, manage the radio, read sensors. And now it also needs to figure out which country it's floating over to follow the law.
So the whole reason for this validation test was that this mapping system would just eat up all the resources, right? That you'd load the map and the whole thing would just crash.
Precisely. That was the number one risk. So the first thing Ingloc validated was the resource footprint. Did it even
What
fit?
was the verdict?
It fit with plenty of room to spare. The code and all the data tables took up about 50 kilobytes of the flash memory.
Okay, so about 20% of the total storage. That seems pretty reasonable for what it's doing.
It's very reasonable. But the RAM usage, the working memory, that is the real headline here. This is the number that makes embedded engineers, sit up in their chairs.
Right, hit me with it.
It used less than 1 kilobyte of RAM.
Wait, hold on. Less than one.
Less than one.
That, honestly, that sounds impossible. I'm skeptical. How do you process a global data set and do all that math in less than a K?
It's all about how the memory is managed.
Yeah.
Because the lookup table, the big list of regions, it's static. It just sits in the flash memory. The processor doesn't need to load the whole map into RAM to read it.
Ah,
It
yeah.
just peeks at the specific address it needs in the flash storage.
So it's like looking up a word in a physical dictionary. You don't have to memorize the entire book.
That is the perfect analogy. You leave the book on the shelf, that's the flash, and you only use your brain, the RAM, to hold the one word you're looking for right now.
That makes so much sense. And that 1 kilobyte footprint is huge for validation. It proves the light in H3 Lite is for real.
Exactly. It proves you don't need a Raspberry Pi or some little Linux computer to do this. You can do it on bare metal.
Okay, so we know it fits. The parachute is packed into the backpack. Now we have to see if it opens. Let's talk about the mission itself. Why does the balloon need to know where it is so badly?
Well, it's about international law and also just not interfering with people. As the balloon drifts, it crosses borders. Radio waves don't care about borders, but radio regulations sure do.
Right, you can't just blast on, say, 915 megahertz everywhere you go.
No. If you're over the United States, you use the US 915 band. If you drift across the Atlantic and get to Europe, you have to switch to EU 868. If you don't, you're basically a rogue transmitter. You could be jamming local networks.
Which is not good.
Not good. And since there's no pilot on board to flip the Europe switch, the code has to do it all by itself.
And it has to do it fast, I imagine.
Reliably and fast. The balloon gets a GPS update, and it needs to decide immediately, am I over France or am I over Spain? The design target for this project was under 100 milliseconds.
So how did they test this? They didn't actually launch 35 balloons all over the world, did they?
No. That would blow the budget in about 5 minutes. They used what's called a profiling suite.
So they just fed the chip a list of fake GPS coordinates.
Exactly. 35 carefully selected scenarios, and they timed exactly how long it took to get an answer for each one.
It's like a flight simulator for the code.
It is. And they used a tool called Seger RTT for the timing.
What's RTT? Is that just a fancy stopwatch?
It's much more sophisticated. It stands for real-time transfer. It's a way for the chip to send debug messages to a computer incredibly quickly without slowing itself down.
So the act of measuring doesn't interfere with the measurement.
Exactly. It's like a high-speed stethoscope.
Mm-hmm.
It lets you measure the heartbeat of the code without disturbing the patient.
That's a great image. So the stethoscope is on the chip. Let's get to the results. They started with what developers call the happy path.
The easy ones, yeah. The balloon is floating dead center over a major city. They tested Los Angeles, Paris, Singapore.
The big hitters.
Melbourne, Seoul, you name it.
And what was the verdict? How fast was that lookup?
It was incredibly consistent. In every single one of those cases, the lookup time was exactly 2 milliseconds.
2 milliseconds.
2 milliseconds.
That is, I mean, for human perception, that's just instant. A blink is what? 100 milliseconds?
Way faster. It's instantaneous for all practical purposes.
But what I find so interesting is the consistency. Why wasn't finding Melbourne any slower than finding Paris?
That's the beauty of the algorithm. It validates the choice of a binary search. It's looking through a sorted table of about 10,953 entries.
Okay, unpack binary search for us. Why does that make it so consistent?
Okay, so imagine you're looking for a word in a dictionary. A linear search would be starting at page one and reading every single word. If your word is zebra, you're going to be there a while.
Right.
A binary search is how we actually use a dictionary. You open it to the middle. Is your word before or after this page? You throw away the half you don't need, and you cut the other half in the middle again.
The game of high-low.
Exactly. And mathematically, to find one item in almost 11,000 takes about 14 comparisons. Every single time. It doesn't matter if the answer is at the beginning or the end of the list.
And engineers love that predictability.
We live for determinism. This 2 millisecond result just confirms that the Cortex M4 isn't even breaking a sweat. It's breezing through it.
Okay, so if you are over land, you are golden. But balloons drift over the ocean, and this is where things get a bit more complex.
This is where we get into the edge cases, and specifically the offshore ring search.
Right. Because if you're, say, 10 miles off the coast of California, you're not in the U.S., the map just says water.
Correct. But your radio can still reach a gateway on the shore. So you need to use the U.S. frequency, even though you aren't physically on U.S. soil.
The system has to be smart enough to say, I'm not in a region, but am I near one?
And that's what the expanding ring search does. Think of dropping a pebble in a pond.
The ripples.
Exactly. The system checks the hexagon where the balloon is. Nothing there. Okay, let's check the 6 immediate neighbors. That's ring 1. If it finds a region there, it just adopts it.
And if not?
It expands to ring 2. Then ring 3, and so on, until it either finds something or hits a predefined limit.
Now, that's obviously more work. So does the speed hold up?
It slows down, but in a completely predictable, linear way. A direct lookup was 2 milliseconds. A ring 1 search, which covers a radius of about 65 kilometers, took 4 milliseconds.
So double the time, but 4 milliseconds is still nothing.
It's nothing. And that ring 1 search covered a lot of their test cases. The Atlantic, west of Ireland. The Mediterranean, south of France, all resolved in 4 milliseconds.
So for most coastal flights, it's fine. Did they push it harder?
They did. They used a specific NYC offshore marker.
Ah, New York City.
That location required a ring 2 search. We're talking a radius of about 130 kilometers now, so well offshore.
And the time?
8 milliseconds.
Okay, I see the pattern. 2, 4, 8. It's scaling up.
It scales linearly with the work. But even at 8 milliseconds, we are way, way below that 100 millisecond budget.
So what was the absolute breaking point, the worst case scenario?
They tested a ring 6 search.
Ring 6? How far out is that?
Almost 400 kilometers. We're talking remote ocean areas now. You're barely likely to reach a gateway, but the system still checks.
And the result for that?
43 milliseconds.
43.
That's the longest time they recorded.
Right.
But think about it. The absolute worst case scouring hundreds of kilometers of ocean is still more than twice as fast as it needs to be.
That's incredible. It proves the worst case isn't actually that bad.
Exactly. Even when the algorithm's working its hardest, the balloon won't notice the delay.
The ocean is big. What happens when the balloon is truly alone, mid-Pacific?
They call that the void.
The void. I love that the engineering logs call it that.
It's fitting. They tested 7 locations where the system just found nothing, more than 600 kilometers from land.
So it runs its rings, expands all the way out, and comes up empty. What does the robot do then? Does it panic?
No, this is crucial. It enters a controlled fallback mode. It returns a specific no region code. The main firmware sees that and says, okay, I'm in the wild. I'll stay quiet, save battery, and wait for the next GPS update.
That's actually really smart. No point shouting into the void.
It's a success, not a failure. It correctly identified those locations.
Now, there was one other weird scenario that caught my eye. The ambiguous zones.
Ah, yes. The Caribbean Sea.
Because geography is messy.
It is. They tested a spot where the balloon was roughly equidistant from two different regions. It found both the U.S. standard, U.S. 915, and the Australian standard, AU 915, which is used in parts of South America. Both were about 260 kilometers away.
So it has two valid options. How does the code decide?
It does the simplest thing possible. It picks the first valid region it finds in its search loop.
It just calls dibs on the first one?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
First come, first served. In this context, it's the right move. The worst thing it could do is get stuck trying to decide which is better. Indecision is the enemy of embedded systems.
That's a great point. You don't want it pondering philosophy while it misses its transmission window.
Oh.
So let's look at the final scorecard. 35 test points.
100% accuracy. It didn't get a single country wrong.
And the success rate.
It found a region in 28 of the 35 points, so 80%. The other 20% were those deep ocean void locations where no region was the correct answer.
And I saw they visualized this on a 3D globe.
Yeah, using a tool called CZMJS. And it's so important because it lets you actually see the H3 hexagons and the search rings expanding. It makes these abstract numbers, 4 milliseconds, ring 2 tangible.
It bridges that gap we talked about. It makes the code part of the physical world.
Exactly.
So what's next for H3 Lite? Is it ready for launch?
Almost. The blog mentions investigating a tiny discrepancy they found near New York City, of course.
New York again.
It's a complex coastline. But after that, the ultimate test is field validation, putting it on a real balloon and letting it go.
Seeing if it actually switches frequencies at 60,000 feet.
That's the final frontier.
Yeah.
But based on these results, confidence is very high.
You know, I want to go back to that memory number. Less than 1 kilobyte of RAM.
1 kilobyte.
We live in an age of software bloat. My desktop messaging app takes up 200 megabytes of RAM just to sit there. And here we have a system mapping global regulations and a sliver of memory so small it's basically a rounding error.
It really challenges the assumption that complex means heavy. It proves that if you choose the right algorithms and data structures, you can solve massive problems on very modest hardware.
It feels like a lost art, doesn't it? Optimization.
It does. We got a bit lazy because hardware got cheap. We just throw more RAM at the problem. But in the stratosphere, or in a battery-powered sensor, you can't do that. Constraints breed creativity.
That's a powerful lesson. When you can't buy more RAM, you have to write better code.
Exactly.
So here's a thought for you to take away. We just talked about a tiny chip that can figure out its regulatory home on the entire planet in 2 milliseconds.
2 milliseconds.
If we can do that. What other complex problems are we just overcomplicating? How many other systems are we throwing massive processors at just because we haven't found the light version of the solution yet?
That is the question.
Think about the projects you work on. Where are your edge cases? And do you have a plan for when your system is floating 600 kilometers from nowhere in the void?
Because if you don't handle the void handles you.
Something to mull over. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
My pleasure.
We'll catch you on the next one. Keep looking up.